Killing Mildred by Charlie Fish. I paid my way through university by doing evening shifts as a care assistant at Brookbourne Manor. Before that I was doing bar work, but I hated it, so I traded the fusty smell of sweat and beer for the sting of ammonia and carbolic acid. The manor had 16 residents most of the time. My job was to clear away their supper and do the dishes, then help put them all to bed. That really took less than 5 hours between the two of us. When I say the two of us, I mean me and Danny. She'd been doing this job for 10 years. She was 30-something, a mother of two, and a real prankster. She teased me no end. I hated it sometimes, but her stories kept the residents entertained. On my first night, she showed me Mrs. Thwaite's bedtime routine. Mrs. Thwaite was frail as a breadstick. We had to help her undress and toilet. There's a word I've never used outside of that job. Toilet as a verb. After Mrs. Thwaite was done toileting, she called us back in and we helped her to her feet. "I'll back off now and talk you through it," Danny said, leaving Mrs. Thwaite half naked, propped up against the sink. "First, wipe her bum." Eager to make a good impression, I didn't hesitate. I unrolled 3 sheets, folded them around my fingers as a barrier, and tenderly applied them to Mrs. Thwaite, who winced and sucked her teeth in pain. "Okay, now you look at her poo, see if there's any blood in it," said Danny. I looked in the toilet bowl, just one pebble, black like a raisin. "And you smell it, see if it's normal-like." I took a deep lungful. "Okay, flush, and put just a touch of talc on her pussy." I looked at Danny, ready to admonish her for using disrespectful language. Her expression was earnest. I looked at Mrs. Thwaite, whose hollow face remained perfectly vacant, and my confidence dissolved. I tipped some talcum powder onto my hand and slapped it on. Mrs. Thwaite's eyes flicked downwards for half a second, then returned to the mirror above the sink. Apart from that, she didn't move. Danny managed to keep a straight face for about 3 seconds before exploding into a mocking laugh. She told that story about how she had made me pad Mrs. Thwaite's pussy for months afterwards. It was a year before I realized I wasn't supposed to smell the resident's poo. So, yes, Danny was a practical joker. Her mood carried the whole place. When she was joking around and making fun of me, the residents complained less and things went more smoothly. We all quietly feared the times when Danny came in feeling low. She'd start talking about how her life was going nowhere, and suddenly Dennis's liver would play up, Mildred would start vomiting, Floris would cry, Mr. Anders would refuse to eat. I would gladly trade that for a dose of humiliation as the butt of a practical joke. Even when the residents were in a relatively good mood, they did a lot of complaining, especially Mrs. Cobbler. She hobbled into the lounge with her Zimmer frame after supper every day, commandeered the remote control and sat in the high back chair with the floral print to watch EastEnders. God forbid anyone should want to watch something else, or worse, be sitting in her chair. She once laid out Mr. Davies for suggesting that they switch over to the horse racing. He hit his head on the coffee table and bled all over the afghan. I had to bind his head with a tea towel until the ambulance came, and we never saw him again. But even when Mrs. Cobbler got her way, as she always did, she complained. The volume was too low or too high, or there was a glare on the screen, or Mildred was making too much noise, or Dennis was in the way. It was her hobby, I suppose. There was nothing else to do in there. There really was nothing for them to do. Very few of them ever left the manor. There were hardly ever visitors. They were like mice in a maze, lost in little circles. Danny and I tried to come up with new ways to entertain them. We arranged a bingo night and poker once. We rented movies. I always promised Mrs. Farrier a game of Scrabble, but I never got round to it. We even took Dennis out to the local pub once, off duty, of course. He ended up getting so drunk he tried to get off with the cigarette machine, and we had to carry him back to the manor while he recited "Stop all the clocks" to the evening air. Only one resident always had a smile on her face. Mildred Merrihap, my favourite. When I hated my job most, I spoke to Mildred and she would give me courage. When Mrs. Thwaite had a rectal prolapse from straining too hard on the toilet, and I had nightmares for days about shitting out my lungs, or when I was shaving around Mr. Anders's stoma so the colostomy bag would stick, and I nicked a bit of skin, and there was blood and shit everywhere and it smelled like dead birds, Mildred got me through. Mildred suffered from the worst case of senile dementia I have ever seen. She wandered around the manor, gibbering and jabbering to herself, drooling fetid saliva from her brown-toothed mouth, but she was always smiling. She always seemed to be enjoying herself. "How are you today, Mildred?" I would say to her. "And he said he wanted to grow rhododendrons," she'd respond and laugh as if it was the punchline to a joke she'd been building up to for 20 minutes. "Who said they wanted to grow rhododendrons?" I'd ask, fascinated by her parallel world. "Yes, yes, and how are you doing at school?" she'd say, beaming. "Well, university is hard work at the moment, as it happens," I'd say, speaking slowly in case she understood. "I have exams coming up next week and I don't feel ready. I'm not even sure I've chosen the right degree." "Rupert called, did he? He's such a kind man," she'd say, shaking her head in happy reminiscence. "He bought me flowers once, you know." "Who's Rupert?" I'd ask, and so the conversation would spiral onwards. Her smile was broken and ugly and smelled of old grass, but she was so carefree it always made me feel better. I'm a little ashamed to admit it, but I think I gave Mildred preferential treatment. When it came to the bedtime rounds, I rushed through Cobbler, Thwaite, Farrier, the Anderses, Dennis, Floris, whoever else, and I saved Mildred for last. I spent twice as much time cleaning her up and changing her, chatting all the time. My life was moving so fast back then. The beats that marked time passing, that marked me growing up, were vivid. Graduating from school, leaving my parents' home, starting university, losing my virginity, my first this, my first that. It felt like a different world when I came to the manor. A slower world, not somewhere I really belonged. Here the beats of time were faint, like a dying pulse. And Mildred was the only person I could talk to about how I felt, not just in the manor, but anywhere. I told her things I didn't even tell my best friends. I told her how it might have been my fault when I crashed my flatmate's car. I told her how anxious I was of going back to live with my parents for the summer. I told her when Mr. Anders soiled his bed and I couldn't bear to deal with it, so I pretended I hadn't noticed and left it for Danny. And she always responded with meaningless half-sentences and semi-articulated recollections of unknown friends. She kept all my secrets and fears locked up inside her where no one could get at them. Mildred was the reason I stayed at the manor, and she was also the reason I left. At the beginning of my final year at university, Mildred fell ill. She started going straight back to bed as soon as the morning staff had got her out, and then she stopped eating, and soon she had a temperature. She deteriorated quickly. One week I was joking with her about how awful it was to be ill, and the next week I was feeding her through a syringe. My stomach tightened when her joyous smile was interrupted by woeful moans from some uncommunicated pain. She stopped talking about chrysanthemums and Joe from down the road and descended into feverish mumblings. In the third week of her illness, Danny and I were checking on Mildred every half an hour. We had propped her up in her high-backed armchair and wrapped her in quilts. She looked so small and still, breathing fast like a mouse. And she was completely unresponsive. Danny even balanced a teacup on her head for me to find when I next checked up on her. After I cleared away the teas and coffees and finished washing the dishes, I pureed a portion of chicken and veg for Mildred. I funneled it into the plastic syringe and went up to feed her. Her eyes were closed and she was murmuring quietly. I knelt down and put my head next to hers. All of the wrinkles on her forehead were knotted to a point at the bridge of her glasses, and I realized that I was frowning too, a mirror image. "How are you today, Mildred?" I said. I wanted to speak more, to reassure her, but I couldn't think of anything to say. Instead, in silence, I put my hand to her cheek and ran my fingers along her wrinkles, cold and weak like wet paper. I breathed in her breath. It was a disgusting smell, but with a subtle note of compost sweetness. I brought the food syringe to her lips, and she closed them and turned her head away. "You've got to eat," I said, "or you'll never get well." "No, no," she said distinctly. "Mildred," I said, and gently held her chin while I squeezed half of the contents of the syringe into her mouth. She coughed and pulled her head away, spitting the food out onto her quilt. Her breath rattled now. It sounded like sucking a straw in an almost empty glass of water. I pulled a cloth out of my pocket and mopped up the spilt food. Then I grabbed her jaw, firmly this time, hard enough to leave two burgundy bruises. She tried to clench her teeth, but I forced them apart with the plastic mouth of the syringe. She opened her eyes, stretched wide, and stared at me as I squeezed the rest of the food down her throat. Half an hour later, I was watching TV on my own in the lounge when an assistance alarm went off. I glanced over to the board and saw that it was coming from Mildred's room. When I got there, I saw that it was Danny who had pressed the button. "Mildred's carked it," she said. She took off Mildred's glasses and closed her eyes with her thumb and forefinger. "Help me get her onto the bed." I walked up to the armchair and put my hand on Mildred's shoulder. "Her neck's already hard," I said, "like rigor mortis." "Reckon it's the draft what's done it," said Danny, and she leant over to close the window. We cast Mildred's quilts aside and heaved her up onto the bed. She looked like she should weigh no more than a screwed-up ball of paper, but she was surprisingly heavy. "I'll call the doctor to declare it. You finish putting Dennis to bed. He's toileting right now," instructed Danny, and she left the room. I lingered. I had never seen a real dead person before. I wanted to say something to her, but it felt inappropriate. I watched her for a minute, then I picked up the quilts from the floor and put them over her. I perched on the bed next to her, put my fingers against her tiny wrist, and held them there. I could swear I felt a pulse, but maybe it was my own. I looked at all the boxes and photos on her dresser. What would happen to all her stuff, I wondered. Did she have any family who would want it? One of the photos, black and white, was of a young woman on a pony, her plaid skirt billowing in the wind. Another was of a soldier, stern and handsome, looking up as if he saw the future. It was easy to think of the residents as something less than human. Mrs. Thwaite, the rectal prolapse, Dennis, the alcoholic, Floris, the manic depressive, Mildred the smiley loon. They were caricatures, dolls that you had to dress and undress, and when undressed they looked less like people and more like warted gourds. Mildred was a woman. For 80 years she had fought and loved and wanted and searched for meaning, and she had ended up here. The last voice she had ever heard had been mine, a total stranger's. I had loved her, but I didn't really know her at all. There must have been people out there who knew her. They would never know about me, that I dressed and undressed her, that I cleaned her when she pissed herself, that I confessed my darkest fears to her because she couldn't understand, that I was sitting next to her, feeling her wrist for a pulse. I felt deeply ashamed. I handed in my notice a week later. I hadn't realized how much I'd loved working there until Mildred died, and I stopped enjoying it at all. I couldn't look straight into Danny's eyes when I told her I was leaving. I haven't spoken to her, or any of them, at all since then.
And to round off the evening, we have John Carlos, who will be reading.